Welcome, everyone, to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson. For this version of the podcast, my co-hosts are Mark Johnson and Kevin Christensen. Our discussion topic for this podcast will be a little miscellaneous, but we're going to talk about an entry on a Times and Seasons post that talks about plausibility that I found very interesting. We'll also talk about the Interpreter Foundation birthday that we celebrated week or two ago from when we've recorded, but it was early August. It's the 13th birthday of the Interpreter Foundation. The mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. Now, if you like this podcast, please tell your friends about it. Give us a 5-star rating, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, Libsyn, or any other podcast app. I don't know how many others there are. I'm sure there are plenty, because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The comments we make are solely our responsibility. But because you guys are working with me and I'm a lawyer, I will defend you if you say something, okay? One of my favorite lines ever that spawned a lawsuit was in the Farms Review, and it was called, "Corihor's back, and this time he's got a printing press." Do you remember that, Kevin?
Oh, yes.
I remember that.
Actually contributed to the volume of that, I think.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I liked it.
Go ahead. Yeah, we'll reminisce about that sometime.
Yeah, we could reminisce about another time. But it was accurate, but I think it's interesting that they made such a hullabaloo about that one, and yet I think that was the only essay that Stephen Robinson contributed to the review in 22 volumes. And this is going to go into probability or plausibility structures in a minute. It's Thomas Kuhn talks about how our paradigms, our frameworks are established by these standard examples, things that we're taught, a way of viewing the world, and plausibility structures have a lot to do with that, just our environment. But they're established by which examples you pick to generalize from. And that line stands out because it was exceptional, not because it was typical. It wasn't inaccurate, but not every essay was like that. You know, and just a couple of weeks ago, I saw an interview with John DeLynn where he was claiming that that's, you know, all we do is ad hominem. That's our standard method of operation. And but he provides no examples.
Well,
he just says it like it's just, it's not to be argued. It's just, he applies the label and then you're supposed to just accept, well, he must know what he's talking about. But even though back in the day I heard him solicit his readership, is listeners, to send him examples of ad hominem arguments, and people would say, oh, I know you're going to get some great ones, but they never got them.
There's a lot of people in this world I'd love to debate publicly, and I think he's one of them, but you know, there's really no point in that. So let me set the stage for this. Kevin, you're more involved in the what's called the bloggernacle, if you will, maybe, than I am. You go on Reddit, which I think I've only been on twice in my life.
I've only been a couple of times. I
felt like I was caught in a riptide before I knew it, and I just had to get out of it. And I go to Twitter more often than I do that. And I don't go to Twitter very often either. I feel like I have to take a shower when I'm done.
I've never done Twitter.
So anyway, Times and Seasons is a really good one. There's a regular contributor there named Stephen C. And our discussion today, I don't want to take a shot at it. Okay. I mean, I like what he has to say. I don't agree with him all the time. In fact, maybe rarely. But on the other hand, he puts things in a way that is a really good argument, and it's something that we want to talk about. So the title of this one that was dated August 2nd is Plausibility Structures, Intellectuals, and the Church's Truth Claims. So and I'm just going to quote from it a little bit here. Since I was young, an impromptu thought experiment has intermittently popped up in the back of my head that's made me think deeply about the nature of my modern faith. Assume that the church was not restored in 1830, and we don't know anything about the Book of Mormon. And in 2025, somebody knocks on your door and says God is speaking to man again, and that the person's brother has uncovered gold plates, yada, yada. So that set that stage for a second. And then we go on, and there's a lot more here that we can talk about. But in the headline, it talks about plausibility. And I want to talk about plausibility in a way that one of my friends who left the church some time ago, but really struggled, and he and I wrestled with that for about 10 years before he finally decided to step away. Even when I first met him, like 20 years ago, he would say at that time, he had a real hard time swallowing, in his words, the story of Joseph Smith and the angel and the gold plates. Martin Tanner and I are getting ready to interview John Tanner. Turner has the same problem in his new Joseph Smith biography. You know, how do you accept this? For some people, that's not plausible. And if it's not plausible, or when you lose your ability for it to be plausible, you can no longer have faith in it. You can no longer believe in it. And it kind of ties in for me with Alma chapter section 32. You have to have the desire to believe. You have to have the least kernel. And if you, for some reason, your brain can't wrap around the story that, okay, I can accept that an angel came to Joseph Smith. That doesn't mean I believe it at this stage, but at least it's something I can believe. But if I can't believe at all that there are angels, and I can't believe, what was the famous Sterling McMurrin quote?
You don't get books from angels and translate them by revelation. It's just
exactly,
that simple.
Exactly. Yeah. That's where it kind of falls out. And that my train of thought on this post immediately started with that. And anyway, he says, I've come to some conclusions. Okay. So the vast majority of us, according to him, wouldn't give the person the time of day, would think his brother's a little crazy. How should we treat this any differently now than in 1830? I'm paraphrasing a little bit. Okay. So then he gives us a pro-faith one. I think he gives us one that's a little less pro-faith, if you will. But he talks a lot about what he calls plausibility structures. Kevin, tell me, and then Mark, tell me what your response is to some of the things that we're seeing here.
Okay. Well, the idea of the plausibility structure, the way he defines it, he says, basically, when other people around you believe something, it normalizes it, because our gut reaction is that there has to be something to it if so many people hold to it. And that, of course, that reminds me of something else that I've used quite a bit. I mean, I'll talk about Thomas Kuhn a lot, but there's something called the Perry scheme of cognitive and ethical growth. And some years ago, an LDS writer named Veda Hale sent me this thing. And it was based on a study that a guy at Yale, or rather Harvard, rather, I guess he was at Harvard, and he was just studying the way that incoming students from, you know, their little local communities would come into the Harvard lifestyle and there be exposed to just a far broader range of thought and culture and different ideas and the kind of transitions they'd go through. And Veda's little summary of this says that the basic thing is basic duality. You know, all will be well, and there's just this sense that everything, you know, that everything is simple. Position two, I like, and it's called multiplicity pre-legitimate, resisting snake. You get the Eden metaphor. Now the person moves to accept that there is diversity, but they still think that there are true authorities who are right, and others, and that the others are confused by the complexities or are just frauds. They think they are with the true authorities and are right, while all others are wrong. They accept that their good authorities present problems so that they can learn to reach right answers independently. Well, this is a plausibility structure. It's based on what everyone in your community thinks. And there's a quote that I put into one of my last essays that I like a lot about a plausibility structure. Think about this one. Bacon, the philosopher of science, was quite consistently an enemy of the Copernican hypothesis. Don't theorize, he said, but open your eyes and observe without prejudice, and you cannot doubt that the sun moves and that the earth is at rest. Well, he had a pre-existing plausibility structure, and he couldn't get out of it. Now, we're in a different one, and we can look back at Bacon and say, well, he was wrong because, you know, we have a different framework. We've seen a lot of things that he not only didn't see, but couldn't see. They didn't have the tools and resources. And so there's this process over time. I had a friend back in California said to me, how can you be a Mormon and intellectual? I thought that was a very good question. I had another guy who left the church, and he said, how can you know what you know and believe what you believe? So, and they're, each of one is speaking from this community framework. Well, you know, the one who's saying, how can you be a Mormon and intellectual? You know, my answer to him was, well, maybe I know more about it than you do. And he had to admit that that was a good answer. You know, and I found out he had some preconceptions that just didn't fly. And he accepted, oh, yeah, I don't have to be a young earth creationist or a fundamentalist to be LDS. You know, I can embrace science and all of this. And I get permission to do that, I think, from our scriptures. Then this idea that, you know, with the Perry scheme is that we all start in a community with this, or our teachers, our authorities, our family. That's a starting point, but everybody starts there. But eventually you're going to come up against another community. And especially in modern life, we've got television, and we used to have newspapers and magazines. Now it's, you know, internet and blogs and different news channels and different authorities that are all, you know, claiming that their way is the right way. And I think we soon have to realize, we have to figure out for ourselves, well, I was born into this, right? And that's what he's saying. I was born into this, but what if, what about these other worldviews? And I've been fascinated by this for 50 years, you know, since I went on my mission, and I talked to these people, and I think, gee, it's so obvious to me, why can't they see it? And that was my initial kind of question, where, well, I want to understand this and look at my own faith and see, okay, they don't think it's plausible, but I do. What makes the difference? And start looking at that. And later on in the essay, he starts talking about, well, experts. There's people like Hugh Nibley gives us permission to believe certain things because he comes up and he gives us something we didn't have to look at. And we see our own scriptures in a new way. Like, so my community taught me that when I read King Benjamin's discourse, you know, people come together, they listen to the speech, and they're all impressed. Well, I'd been to conference. I'd been to state conferences, you know, and that was my framework. But then a member on my mission loaned me a copy of An Approach to the Book of Mormon. And I took it to the tub on a P day and thought, I'll just read the interesting chapters. And I read the whole book. But I'd had an investigator about a year before that say his plausibility structure. He read King Benjamin's discourse where everybody's converted, everybody makes the covenant. He says that doesn't happen. Not everyone would have believed it. I don't believe it. People aren't like that. And when I was 19 years old, all I could say was, it was a good speech. But I kept the question. And when I read Nibley's, the chapter 23, Old World Ritual in the New World, Nibley takes us back and he shows us an ancient coronation ceremony. I hadn't been taught that before, hadn't imagined it before. What goes on in an ancient coronation? And Nibley takes us through, he looked, you know, researched all these ancient writings and found that there is this ritual. 36 things happen in order. One of the things that happens is what they call the acclamatio, where everyone is supposed to fall down and make the covenant. It was a ritually conditioned behavior. And we have been conditioned that way. So what Nibley did was he took me inside a different plausibility structure. When Nephi says, you can't understand the things of the Jews, save you are taught after the manner of the things of the Jews. You also get Brigham Young saying something like that I really like. If there's one thing that I could impress upon the saints in a way that it would remain with them, and that is to understand people as they are and not as you are. That is to be able to just, instead of thinking that I'm the center of the universe and I see things as they are and everybody else is, you know, is wrong, to be realized that I'm finite, I'm human, I'm limited. And these people I've had a different experience. They may have been born in a different faith, a different community, a different culture, speak different languages. There is something different going on. And in encountering that forces me to look at myself and sometimes look at myself in a different way and to realize I don't know everything. I want to know more. And so the Perry scheme, Thomas Kuhn, science, Mormonism, the hero's journey, and the Joseph Campbell Tear with a Thousand Faces are all about the adventure of going outside the community and having this, you know, the call to adventure is, whoa, how do I account for this stuff? You know, these other people have a completely different experience. This thought experiment, you know, what if I wasn't born in the church? What if someone just came knocking on the door and told me this weird story? How would I react? What can I do? How can I test it? What's the plausibility? Well, part of that is somebody like Nibley or Richard Bushman has gone off on the hero's adventure, comes back with a boon, gives it to his community. Well, I read it, it expands my mind, and it also said, and it just doesn't answer that question. Sets a pattern. How am I going to deal with the situation when it comes up? Well, I've got the Book of Mormon, I can read it myself. I've got experts I can turn to. One of the things that impresses me, say, about the whole my whole experience with LDS apologetics, especially the Farrar's Review, was the range of people with impressive expertise on a wide range of subjects that would come in and answer these questions, so that something that a critic would say, "This is so wrong, it doesn't make any sense. You might as well dump the whole thing." They'd come back and have a new way of framing it, and I'd realize, well, yeah, not only is the Book of Mormon plausible, it's better than I imagined it was. It's exciting. I want to learn more. What else about it am I missing? You know, so what can start out as this question, you know, the thought experiment, there's a way to answer it. And Terry mentioned Alma 32. You know, that's you have a desire to believe, desire to figure out. You just want to know, well, is this true? Should I commit my life to this? Well, there are experiments we can't perform. There are heroes who have gone on the adventure and who have offered boons to us. There are personal experiments we can make ourselves. You know, and it starts with just, you know, you read the book, you plant the word, you experiment with it. You see whether your mind expands, whether your understanding grows. If you take a question and you can just, you know, you can pop like a balloon, or you can give it time. Keep your eyes open and see what happens. And it's this ongoing feedback and excitement that for me is the thing that makes it not only just plausible or exciting. You know, I don't have to think it's irrational. I can't prove what I believe to somebody else, but I can show them my cause to believe, the things that have impressed me. And I can say, this impresses me, and this impresses me. And I've got, you know, all of these books, you know, covering these walls here. And other people who know things, you know, things that I haven't explored yet that I can still learn from. So for me, it's the thought experiment is a place to start, but that's, you know, I'm a lot further down the trail than that.
Well, you know, one of the things that he mentions here is it makes sense for God to restore a church in 1830 in America in a way it wouldn't in 2025, or say in medieval Japan. And I tend to agree with that, but it's like, where is the top growth in the church happening right now? Africa. Okay. And it's because the people there, they don't have the same culture that we come from here in 21st century United States. Where ritual is just dead. And you know, I think it and it's a fascinating thing to see. And people always accuse the church of being all American and all this, it's an American religious, this is this and this. But when you look at the members of the church now around the world and how the church is gathering their testimonies and gathering their history, the Saints Volume 4, I gotta tell you, from a narrative standpoint, in terms of getting from point A to point B, it's kind of a mess. But on the other hand, following these people through their faith journeys all around the world is just captivating. And there are more and more projects like this where people, they believe in the Book of Mormon. They feel Joseph Smith in a way that we here in the United States and even in Utah do not. And it's like, that is so inspiring to me. It adds to my plausibility structure, if you will.
It's this thing that can grow, and is it, and the, whether it stays plausible after you experiment, and also what kind of experiments do you perform? And that's one of the things that, like, I get from the Bible, is you can see different experiments being performed. Can anything good come from Nazareth, you know, or sort of thing, or have any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed on him? Those are kind of experiments, but those particular experiments don't have anything to do with whether it's real or not. It's what somebody's opinion is. The questions that you know I like to ask, and Nibley was asking, you know, and that my investigator asked, and you know, didn't get a good answer, but he just only measured it against his own plausibility structure. Whereas what Nibley did is he went out and he looked in the ancient world and says, what goes on in the ancient world? And then the question is, how did that get in the Book of Mormon? And that's a really good question that I have never seen anybody come close to answering. I've rarely seen it acknowledged. The only discussion I've seen, like, of that chapter in by a skeptic in Nibley's in approach to the Book of Mormon, is that in New Approaches to the Book of Mormon, that, you know, the signature book that came out many years ago, Brent Metcalf footnoted it when he was discussing. He was claiming that that it follows a revival pattern, you know, of, you know, the of he's comparing it to revival sermonizings, but he has this 4-step pattern, and he uses language that is, you know, foreign to the Book of Mormon experience and what Benjamin describes. He footnotes it, but he doesn't deal with it. He doesn't say, well, this is better, this is more accurate, this is more detailed, this is more comprehensive, this is
Well,
more
he
enlightened.
can't, for one
Yeah, he
thing.
can't. So they don't. And so, like, and I've been impressed whenever I've read, you know, some of these outside experts that are going to, you know, come in and explain away the Book of Mormon. The thing that strikes me most often, well, every time, I mean, to this point, I've been doing this for 50 years now, they come far, far short of defining the problem that the Book of Mormon represents. You know, like with this quote that I just gave from about Bacon. He says, don't theorize, he said, but open your eyes and observe without prejudice, and you cannot doubt that the sun moves and that the earth is at rest. Jesus says criticism, discernment, starts with self-reflection. Bacon's problem isn't that he isn't rational, scientific, logical, knowledgeable, a good person. His problem is that he's not self-reflective. He doesn't bother to examine, he doesn't bother to say, what would it look like if I was on a planet, an Earth that was going around a sun and rotating? What would that look like? He doesn't even imagine it. And the people that were imagining it, like Kepler and Copernicus and Galileo, he wouldn't step into their world. He wouldn't do the experiment. He wouldn't say, well, which is better? You know, he's just saying, well, that can't be right. That's not the same thing as saying, who's got the better case at this point, and what happens to the case over time? Matt, I think we've talked about how Matt Roper's study,
Anachronism's book that he
yeah, the
just came out with,
Anachronisms
The
book,
Interpreter. Yeah,
showing,
we talked about that at the birthday, and
we talked
Mark and I
about
will
that,
talk a little about that.
and that's the sort of thing where you plant the seed and watch what happens over time, and
Yeah.
then you have another problem instead of just starting out saying, well, that angel and plate story sounds kind of fishy. That's not fully defining the problem. You know, you haven't read the book, you haven't checked the evidence, you haven't performed the experiment. You've just listened to a story and passed a judgment without any experiment, or you haven't stepped out of your own rules of the game. And Joseph Smith is calling for a different set of rules. You know, we talked about McMurrin. You don't get books from angels, you don't translate them by revelation. It's just that simple. Now, McMurrin was, you know, a great intellectual. You know, I've read a couple of his books, you know, and he's a very impressive thinker. But what doesn't impress me about that statement is that he says, he pref you know, it was comes from an interview with Blake Osler. He says, when I was young, younger than I can remember. Okay.
I
So this
came to that conclusion, and then he just
yeah.
froze in it.
When he's yeah. And so he's never stepped out of that plausibility structure. You know, for all of his knowledge, for all of his learning, it was still a child's insight that binds him for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And Joseph Smith was another child, but not younger than he could remember. You know, he came out of the woods when he was 14 with an experience, and again when he was 17, and then when he's when he's 18, he gets the book, the plates. He shows it to people. He translates it. He provides the Book of Mormon. He puts it in my hands. And McMurrin admitted that he'd never read it.
Yeah. You know, Kevin, it's interesting because you talk about Bacon. Albert Einstein famously got his most of his theories by picturing what would happen. One of my favorite books, one of the first books of the year I did on my program 30 years ago, is a little book of short stories called Einstein's Dreams, which I highly recommend. It's by Alan Lightman. And essentially, it takes a little principle of physics, and it has Einstein having a dream about what a world would be like if that was really the case. So, for example, the higher up you go in altitude, the longer you live. What would that do to our society? Well, people would build buildings on stilts.
Right.
Well, if they could get those extra few seconds, you know, just different wild premises. And I think there's an element when you talk about the self-reflection.
Yeah.
And this is something that I give Stephen C. credit for, is he's going through some intellectual exercises about these things to try and stimulate some thought. And what would this really be like today? And what would it be like now? And it, once again, we see it in the growth of the church and the acceptance of the gospel. And those who accept it are generally not as, if I don't want to say educated, but they're not as bound to the secular world as we are in our Western society. I mean, and I think we're more religious in America maybe than they are in Europe.
Yeah.
And that's why growth in America in the church even now is still higher than it is in Europe.
Oh, yeah. And I just read an article, a notice saying that we set a record for growth. You know, people have been predicting, for years that we're going to be falling apart. You know, I saw Brent Metcalf, saying, with the DNA stuff that, now that we were all doomed, and here we are, and nobody talks
Well,
about it.
There are political parallels to that.
Yeah.
This is the moment now. The truth is going to come out. It's over.
Yeah.
And then it never is.
Yeah. Here's something from the Perry scheme. This is the end of it. You know, instead of saying that, here you are. This is what we get up to, and I think I made a case in one of my essays that that Joseph Smith's trying to lead us to this point. This is position 9. The person now has developed a sense of irony and can more easily embrace others' viewpoints. He can accept life just as that, life, just the way it is. Now he holds the commitments he makes in a condition of provisional ultimacy, meaning that for him, what he chooses to be truth is his truth, and he acts as if it is ultimate truth, but there is still a provision for change. He has no illusions of having arrived permanently on top of some heap. He is ready and knows he will have to retrace his journey over and over, but he has hope that he will do it each time more wisely. He is aware that he is developing his identity through commitment. He can affirm the inseparable nature of the knower and the known, meaning he knows. He, as knower, contributes to what he calls known. He helps wield a community by sharing realization of aloneness and gains strength and intimacy through this shared vulnerability. He has discarded obedience in favor of his own agency, and he continues to select, judge, and build. And that's a mature way of dealing. It acknowledges that we don't know everything.
Yeah.
But I can acknowledge, okay, I don't know everything. But I have confidence that what I know is based on something real. And because I've experimented on it for years and years and years, and I've seen things that I can't deny, and I've got open questions, but the success I've had in dealing with thousands, uncountable questions, gives me this encouragement. Yeah, there's more to learn. And when I get to these moments, a big one was when I read Nibley. For first, and then later when I read Barker, and then there's dozens of other essays and authors, and hundreds,
when
thousands.
I read Christensen, and when Mark read Donald Duck. No.
Yeah. But it's this growth, and that's what Alma 32 talks about. You experience this growth, your understanding increases. And he says, is your knowledge perfect? No. It's not. We don't know everything, but what we know is real. I sometimes tell the story of when I was a very little boy. This is the very edges of my memories. My dad took us out to the Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry in central Utah. And there we there's no at that point there's no visitor center, no parking lot, nothing, just some guys out there exposing bones in the rocks. And what the little boy learned that has never changed is that the bones were real.
Yeah.
I didn't have a complete knowledge of dinosaurs or evolution or the age of the earth or anything. I didn't have any of that. But all that I've learned since then has just increased my understanding, which is still not perfect. But the bones were real. The bones
Yeah.
of my faith, the bones, but book, the Book of Mormon, my the answers to my prayers, the understanding, the pleasure and joy that I have in learning new things, and the idea that when I do this, my faith will increase. If I give it time, keep my eyes opened, and re-examine my own assumptions, yeah, my faith continually increases and gets stronger. And I can sit here and, rant about it in this way. But it's not because I don't know anything, but because I have wrestled and I've enjoyed the wrestling, and I love what grows.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin. We appreciate that those thoughts on that post. Mark, you and I attended the interpreter birthday, which Kevin missed, but hopefully now that he's in the area next
Yes.
year, we'll actually get together in person. Kevin, I tell
Yeah.
Shauna I was very disappointed that you weren't there. Because we talked,
Shall.
we talk about getting together with these groups of highly intelligent people. Mark was referring
Yeah.
to that earlier. That
Yeah.
is the interpreter gathering. I mean, I
Yeah.
walk in that room at our dinner table in the past. We've had dinner with Mark and his wife and John Gee and his wife. Well, I had John Thompson and his wife Stacy, and John Thompson and Gee and I do a different podcast for interpreter, but
Yeah.
we also had a geologist on our at our table who wrote an interpreter article about stones and different things in the Book of Mormon. And then we had the first missionary couple to Rwanda
Wow.
at our table. And it's just just everybody was there. A lot of people were there. Royal Skousen was there for his 95th birthday. I think they sang happy birthday to him, right? Right, Mark?
Was only 85, but yeah, he
Oh,
was
it was
there.
only 85.
He was at our table. Yeah.
Okay, well, Lou Midgley was there, and he's 94,
Yeah.
and still firecracker as ever.
Well, I was hoping to talk to him again.
Well, come next year, he'll probably be there. He
He
seems
told me
to
he
not be
could.
going anywhere.
Told me he'd be there.
Well, there are some events before then that I may get to.
Oh, good. That'll be great. That'll be
Yeah.
great. Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, Lou told me that he'd be there next year. So I asked
Yeah.
him point blank if he'd be there. So it was a really good, yeah, event. It was fun, seeing all my old, radio buddies and now, I guess now podcast buddies. It's nice seeing, all the other folks in Interpreter. I got to, compare notes with Jeff Bradshaw for a little while and talk about some of the projects we got going on, and it was fun. It was
Yeah.
nice
They
seeing
had copies of the new Abraham volume. The
they
family,
did.
Abraham and his family from the conference. They just did the conference in April, Kevin, and the
Okay.
books are out. They're
Yeah.
physically there. You can order them from Amazon, both hardcover, soft cover, the Kindle.
Yep. They're not messing around. It's ready.
No,
It's there.
no. So, Mark,
Coming.
what stood out for you at the birthday?
They had on their table, which they had the copies of their books and the journals and stuff. They had, I don't know if you were able to see this or not. They had it's not showing up on my camera here.
Good.
They had a little handout for a new book coming out in December called In God's Image and Likeness 3.
Yeah.
Of Abraham,
Oh.
Sarah, and Hagar, put together by Jeff Bradshaw, John Thompson, and Matthew Bowen. So
Yeah.
wow, that's
And
something.
I've talked to Jeff. They're about ready to start typesetting. So
Nice.
the goal is they're really pressing hard to get it out in December. I think it's going to slide like they usually do. John was telling me, we talked a little about it on our last podcast. He was telling me that Jeff is quite the perfectionist when it comes to his stuff. So, but it's going to be great. I tell you what, Jeff, when he wrote his first book, I reviewed it on my radio program in St. George. I then interviewed him. And one of the things I said was, this is a book I wish I'd written. I said, sometimes you look at a book like Harry Potter, you wish you wrote it because the author J.K. Rowling is now a billionaire. Okay.
Oh,
But
gee.
this was a book I wish I'd written because I agreed with it so much. I wish that I had done that. So then he came out with the sequel, and now there's this third one. But really, Jeff's true love is the Jacob story. So he's going to follow up this one with the Jacob story down the road, and he's already started. In fact, I think he wrote about Jacob in our last in the 2022 Matt Brown Temple volume,
Temple on Mount Zion.
Temple on Mount Zion. Yeah. And then he's going to do a Joseph volume. And so after that, I think he'll probably be done, but he's doing a lot of other things. You know, one of the other things, Mark, that he talked about was his little film stories about the saints in Africa.
Yep,
It's
not by
called
bread
Not By
alone.
Bread Alone. You can go to notbybreadalonefilm.com and look at some of these. There's about, I want to say, 2 hours of the clips available now. And he said that one has more views in French than it does in English. And it's the only interpreter project that's aimed at in a foreign language.
Wow.
And so then they also talked about a couple of other statistics. One that really stood out, Mark, was that this is our 681st week without interruption of publishing an article in the journal, at least one a week.
Kind of staggering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Well, especially in contrast to what's happened with
You know, yeah.
the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies. You know, that's kind of behind a paywall. And the last time I checked, there was, it's you can see how many times an article has been downloaded,
Yeah.
like five or six.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of sad, but.
No, but they're now up to several movies. We do the podcast. They've published 30 books with more
Wow.
coming. The ones that are coming up next, like he was saying, there's the Temple on Mount Zion number 7, which is the proceedings from the September 24 conference. They have just published the Abraham and His Family in Scripture. They've got the volume 3 that Mark was talking about. And then here's a new one. It's called The Uncollected Works of Hugh Nibley, Volume 1.
Ah, okay.
It's one of them's a story without end, and the other is the unpublished dissertation of Hugh W. Nibley. So, more to
Yeah.
look forward to, Kevin.
Good. Well, I'm looking. They've also announced next May they're going to do a conference on the small plates of Nephi.
Yeah, Mark has made a Mark's trying to get into that.
And I
Yep,
am. I am too.
okay, that's great.
I'm
Both of you
starting to
are.
put. Yeah, I'm starting to put something, a proposal together. We'll see how it
Okay,
goes.
all right. Brothers, we've got to go. Thank you for participating tonight. This is Terry Hutchinson. Thanks for listening to this podcast and join us again soon. This is Terry Hutchinson signing off for Mark Johnson and Kevin Christensen. Thank you.
Okay.
Perfect.
There.